This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her early roles, Helena Bonham Carter seemed made to bring 19th century characters to life. She starred in the films A Room with a View and Howard's End, both based on novels by E.M. Forster. But she traded in English upper-middle-class manners for New York neuroticisms when she played Woody Allen's wife in Mighty Aphrodite. Now in the new film Margaret's Museum, she stars as an independent-minded young woman in a poor coal mining town on Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia. Margaret has already lost her father and a brother to mining accidents. The losses have left Margaret's mother a broken woman. When Margaret falls in love with an itinerant bagpipe player, her mother sees tragedy ahead, even though he earns his money washing dishes in a restaurant and doesn't work in the mines. Here's Margaret, played by Helena Bonham Carter, talking with her mother, played by Kate Nelligan.
He makes me laugh. He make you cry, too. He'll dig coal and make you cry. He's not like that.
Oh.
Then you'll have children to add to your suffering.
Christ, aren't you getting ahead of yourself? All I've done is make him a pie.
That's how it starts.
If it makes you happy, I'll have 5 sons and 3 daughters. I can hear them screaming in the bagpipes, waiting to be born.
I'll tell you what I hear. You lose 2 sons to a shoe factory in Boston and 3 to the pit. One will die with the lungs, 1 from a fall of stone, and 1 will get shot in the face making a speech during a strike.
Well, at least you didn't curse the girls.
Oh, girls, yeah, 1 just like you. Turn her back on her mother. Think of no one but herself. Other one, become a nun. You know why? So she can get as far away as she can from you.
Helena Bonham Carter had to speak with a Cape Breton accent for her role in Margaret's Museum. I asked her about learning it.
Well, the Nova Scotian accent is very particular and rather peculiar. It's a sort of mixture, a hybrid of, sort of Canadian sounds. So you've got the oat, Canadian oat, which, and then you've got a lot of Irish sounds, which is strange because most of them in Nova Scotia, the Nova Scotian people and the Cape Bretoners are of mostly Scottish origin. But so when you're doing the accent, if you do it right, you can very easily sound as if you're doing 2 accents, you know, badly. so there's a problem there. And it's difficult. It was difficult to get to begin with because you were either thinking Irish or then Canadian. It was sort of, and it was to get the right balance right.
Do you think that there are certain preconceptions that people who know you from your Merchant Ivory films might have about you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm plagued by them. Well, not plagued by them because ultimately you can't let them bother you. But I think certainly when they meet you, they you're so different from what I thought. A lot of the, I suppose they just think that, and that's natural, that often happens, is that people confuse the real, you know, what your real self, off-screen self, with the on-screen one that they perceive.
Now, I'll tell you what I always figured from seeing you in, say, Room with a View and Howard's End. I assumed that you had intentionally set out to specialize in this period as an actress and that you were very well read in E.M. Forster.
Well, it's not hard because he only wrote 6 books.
So, is any of that true?
Well, people do think that I must be very cultured and very educated and everything. And to a degree, I guess I'm quite educated, but I'm not particularly cultivated or cultured, I don't think, and I'm not particularly well brought up. I mean, I suppose I have certain, you know, a certain social know-how, but I'm not particularly prim or proper or very snooty. I think people think I might be snooty, which I don't think I am. Or, I mean, most people think that I'm sort of more eccentric. People who know me think that I'm sort of finally sort of playing myself more in parts like Margaret's Museum and other sort of character roles that I played.
Now, how old were you when you made Room with a View?
I was 18.
Now, I think certainly in America that a lot of teenagers, including teenage actors, have insecure voices, rising inflections.
Mm-hmm.
And you've always had a more determined, assured sound and a deeper voice.
Well,
I'm wondering if that's something that you worked on.
No, actually, I saw a bit of A Room with a View not too long ago, and I was surprised at how high my voice was or how low my voice has dropped since then. I mean, a woman's voice tends to mature a lot, I think, in the 20s, and it finally centres and finds its own place, sort of centeredness, late 20s. This is all according to my voice, the voice coach that I worked with. And so I was off centre. I think I was way too high and off and out of control on Room the View. I didn't find myself particularly... I certainly wasn't centred as a person, and the voice is the first thing that tends to reflect, you know, what you are, what state you're at.
How did you start acting? I think you got your first part when you were 16.
It was a bit of an unorthodox beginning in as far as I was at normal school for girls, and in a normal school for girls, that's to say not a drama school or an acting school or a talent school. And a friend of mine was at, who's at school with us, was on television. And there were about five of us who were incredibly envious of this girl who was on television and who received an undue amount of attention at school, we thought. And we all got the same agent individually, not telling this friend, and then went up for parts. And eventually I got a sort of a hi-fi commercial, and I did a bit of Juliet in a speaker, and Romeo was in the other speaker. And then I did a television program playing an Edwardian ghost. And then I got the agent who represents me now, who's a very good one, and he took me on. And at that point, I thought, well, I'm going to go to university and be, you know, responsible and finish my education. He put me up for this film called Lady Jane, which was directed by Trevor Nunn, and that was before Room of the View. That was the first picture that I did, and I got that and didn't go to university. And then immediately after Lady Jane, I did a Room of the View, and that's how it started.
Did you have any acting training when you did Room with a View?
No, none whatsoever. I did, I'd done a few, you know, just plays at school, and I'd done that one television film, so I was completely in at the deep end.
Were you assured on the set, or were you just, you know, covering up an insecurity since you hadn't worked much, you hadn't studied acting?
I think there was a certain confidence that came with the ignorance at that point, you know. And I didn't really know what I was getting in for, and I hadn't seen what I could do yet, or so I just thought I could do it, as it were. I mean, I had a certain amount of confidence just by not having done anything or not really knowing what was involved. Trevor Nunn, though, was a very good director, very kind, the sort of director that assumes as much responsibility for the role as the actor should have. But then I think I took a knock on a Room of the View. I went straight onto that. And by then I thought, oh, I'm in deep water. I really don't know what I'm doing. And I was very conscious of my lack of training and technique and lack of experience. And I was very underconfident on a Room of the View. I remember wandering around Florence thinking I shouldn't be here, and I should be, if I was going to be an actress, carry on being an actress, I should be at drama school or I should be at university. And I was in a muddle, my own Fausterian muddle during that.
Did James Ivory give you any helpful direction?
Jim was, he's more sort of, he casts you and then he lets you get on with it. And then if, you know, he sees you going wrong, then he sort of gently guides you in the right direction. But I think he was bemused at my sort of confusion, as was most people. Most people said, oh, hey, it's great. You know, this is something you should be enjoying. But I just questioned whether I was qualified to do it.
What did you do to prepare for your roles in the Merchant Ivory films, Howard's End and Room with a View?
Well, when you're involved with films which are adapted from novels, you've got just, you know, your great source for information there in the novel. So it was to that I sort of went to, particularly on Howard's End. And she was written so vividly, Helen, that I knew exactly how she should be played. I remember just like in the novel, she was always described by lots of active verbs. She didn't just walk into the room, but she rushed into the room and she flung herself onto the sofa. Everything was very bold and very, you know, described in terms of a lot of motion. And and I remember my mum's a psychotherapist, so sometimes she sort of, she's very good to talk a character through. There's a risk about sort of intellectualizing, but sometimes you just want to know where you're at before you start. And then you have something, you can work somebody out, and it's quite useful to work out why they've become or what they have. And she's usually always takes it back to the childhood and all that.
In Woody Allen's film, Mighty Aphrodite, you played his character's wife and a gallery owner.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to work with Woody Allen?
That came out completely out of the blue. I think it was just Juliet Taylor being imaginative.
His casting director.
Yes. And I was working in Nova Scotia, in fact, at Margaret's Museum, and the call came through and said, will you go to New York and meet Woody Allen? And an audition for this role. I didn't know what the role was, and I appeared, you know, turned up and was given these sheets. I still didn't really gather what kind of role it was from the sheets that I had to read. And then a week later, I didn't read very well. I was very sort of tired for a start, just sort of under par. Also because it was a dream come true to come, you know, to have to come and meet Woody Allen. And so I was a bit nervous, but more so I was just sort of under the weather. And then a week later, they offered me the role. And then I came back to New York because I said, well, can I just see the part before I accept it? Which I think they found a bit cheeky.
Did he give you much direction on how to play your character?
He gave gentle nudges. I think on the whole, I remember him saying, be real and be American, which I sort of figured. We had a laugh. I mean, on the whole, he just sort of... He was very anxious to keep the pace up because... He shoots from mostly from one angle, so you can't, you know, correct the pace through cutting. And then he insists on doing things, on you doing things which you normally don't get to do in normal filmmaking or other films. Insofar as like you know, it's overlapping your dialogue is an imperative, and being obstructed by things. He likes that, and walking out of shot and. With him, you tend to wait for the sun to go in rather than most films, you're waiting all day for the sun to come out. And, anyways, it was fairly relaxed, really, on the whole.
I read that there was a scene where you were both in bed together and he was not only wearing his clothes, he was wearing his shoes.
And his socks, yes. And his socks. Just in case there was a fire. That was
in case there was
story.
A fire?
Yeah.
Did he have a lot of phobias on the set?
He was actually remarkably phobia-free, given the fuss that he makes sometimes. There was some time when we were doing that, we did a taxi cab scene and we were driving around New York and we went, now, I think it's the Pan Am, is it the Pan Am building? So it's not even a tunnel. Is that what?
Oh, the building that you drive under?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you sort of go through it, is that right? But it's not really a tunnel, but he was slightly nervous about going through that. But I went in many a lift with him, but on the whole, he preferred to take the stairs.
Right. My guest is actress Helena Bonham Carter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Helena Bonham Carter. She starred in A Room with a View, Howard's End, and Mighty Aphrodite. Her new film is called Margaret's Museum. Now, I believe it's fair to say that you have ties to the aristocracy in England. Your great-grandfather, I believe, was Prime Minister Herbert Asquith?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is debatable. Carry on and I'll
okay.
discuss it. Anyway.
And your grandmother was in the House of Lords, Violet Bonham Carter.
Yes.
Okay, so what's debatable?
The aristocratic.
Oh, okay.
But it's, you know, it's only because I've sort of, ever since I, you know, became well known, I suppose I've been plagued with this thing that I'm aristocratic and upper middle class, which has sort of served to, you know, compound the typecasting. So there's a slight knee-jerk reaction from me just because I'm not really that at all blue-blooded, certainly not in as far as, you know, being, we don't have a country home, we're not that wealthy. And as for the old titles that seem to suggest that we're aristocratic, there's a difference in England, and this is when I get pedantic and sound, you know, really defensive, but there's, you earn a title, or you know, it's not, or you inherit one. And yes, my great-grandfather was Prime Minister, but he started off life up north, you know, as a merchant, middle class. And then became Prime Minister. And, you know, when you get to be Prime Minister, then you get given a title as a going home present. And then Violet was his daughter, and she became very well known in politics again. So there's a slight difference, you know, well, big difference between, you know, earning a title and sort of getting a sort of veneer, mm-hmm. of, which is what we have, of aristocracy rather than actual genuine, you know, blue-bloodedness.
Your father was a banker, and in fact, I think he'd been acting advisor to the Bank of England. But
yeah.
I believe it was in 1979 he was left partially blind and disabled as a result mm-hmm. of surgery to remove a non-malignant tumor. How did that change his life and your life?
Well, obviously, his life was completely transformed, and absolutely for the worse, in some senses. To be age 50 and then able-bodied and live a full life, his life was, at some point, completely looked as if he wouldn't survive. But through sheer sort of cussed stubbornness and courage and a will to survive, he did. But has remained, as you say, paralysed and partially blind since. So he leads a very circumscribed life, but still lives. And it's often the way that people who are, you know, are in some way disabled, they live often much more fully, you know, fuller lives than those of us who go around able-bodied. So, and I think I'm sure, as far as my life is concerned, I was 13, and strangely enough, looking back at it, I mean, it was then when I sort of got an agent when I was 13 and he was in intensive care. So I think, I don't know if it's complete coincidence, the timing, or there's part of me that felt, well, I've got to sort of look after myself, or a sort of determined optimism. I didn't sort of, I could have, I never really, I think I lived in a state of denial, sort of age 13, with which I think you have to in order to survive, but not thinking that he'd ever die or that it was that tragic. So I sort of, you know, determined to go on and do things. And perhaps that's what instilled in me, you know, a sense of drive, perhaps. You know.
Did you have to spend a lot of time taking care of him?
No. I have to say, I live with my mom and dad, but I have a very easy time. And we're lucky enough to be able to afford nursing, although it's, you know, it's through, you know, medical insurance. And my mother's a remarkable woman, and certainly most of the care has fallen to her and the nurses. But I'm sure it's brought the family, I know it's brought the family much closer as a result, and friends too. And it means that I'm sure too I wouldn't be living at home if that hadn't happened. And we're very much sort of home-oriented, and they are great people, and they're great to be with. And it also means, because he's disabled, there's always a thoroughfare of activity and people, you know, in the house. And it's a, you know, happy home.
Why do you still live at home with your parents?
I think a lot of it's laziness. I'm sure it's something to do with my father being ill and a certain amount of interdependence both ways. And I think I feel very comfortable. I mean, most people come to visit my home want to move in anyway, and they don't blame me at all. They always think I'm slightly weird and that why would anyone want to carry on living with their parents? But once they meet my parents and the home set up, then they don't understand, you know, they understand completely. And it is very, it's a sort of easy option. And I do spend a lot of time away from home and working. And I do think it's quite tough in this profession when you're working so intensely then to stop and then you come back. To particularly when you're working, you're surrounded by a sort of family anyway, which is the crew. And then as soon as the job's over, they evaporate and you can feel very lonely when you're not working. So I find it suits me to live in a, you know, in the bed of a family. But, you know, time has come. I realise age 30 that it's time to move, and I will be moving to a place that I bought on my own.
Oh.
At some time this year, but I have to do it up, and I'm sure it'll take me another 30 years to do it up. knowing me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Helena Bonham Carter stars in the new film Margaret's Museum. It opens Friday.